Good afternoon. Welcome to the Buckmaster Show, coming at you from the Green Thing Socalo Village Studio. I'm Dan Shear, editor of the Green Valley News and the Sahuadita Sun. It is Monday, May 22nd. Bill and Ann are enjoying the Caribbean. Last I saw, they were in Puerto Rico, jetting in just after a storm dropped 3 inches of rain in an hour. So that was some welcome for them. Check out their photos on Bill's Facebook page. We hope they're having a restful couple of weeks away, celebrating their anniversary. The Buckmaster Show comes to you live Monday through Friday, noon to one, or you can check out all the past shows or the live stream at buckmastershow.com. We have a couple of terrific guests on the show today. We're going to start out with Malia Chavez. She is the CEO of Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona, doing great work in an increasingly challenging environment. In the second half of the show, we're going to be joined on the live line by Mike Noble. He is the Chief of Research and Managing Partner at Noble Predictive Insights. They do polling, data analysis, and a whole lot more. Please feel free to join us. If you have a question or comment, you can reach us at 520-790-2040. That's the Buckmaster Show live line, presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. And this is a good time to remind you that the Monday one-on-one is presented by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, family owned and run since 1985. Moe's specializes in custom frame mirrors, wall art, picture framing and hanging services and systems, you name it, Moe's has it. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing at Fort Lowell and Dodge, and at moesgallery.com and on Facebook. And Mo, if you're listening today, I was admiring a friend's artwork over the weekend at his home, and I asked him where he had the beautiful framing work done, and sure enough, Mo's. Mo's Gallery and Fine Framing. Thanks for your good work over there. Welcome, Malia Chavez. I hope you had a good weekend.
Thank you, I did.
And you were named to the position in November for Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona. You're the CEO. It was after a national search that drew about 400 applicants. And you came here after having worked for an organization in San Francisco, but actually this is kind of a homecoming for you.
It is, absolutely. It's been a warm welcome.
Yeah, yeah, literally and figuratively, I guess. But Cholla High School grad?
Yes. And, go Chargers.
Okay. Good for you. And so is it good to be back now?
Yes, it's been wonderful being back. Tucson is definitely home for me. And it's just been wonderful to see how the community has also grown and to see that the support and generosity of the community hasn't changed one bit.
Well, you're in a good position to see a lot of that as the head of the Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona. Give us some numbers, clients served, volunteers, what the budget is, and how things are going right now.
Sure. So we serve about 35,000 people a month throughout all five counties. So that's between Pima, Santa Cruz, Greenlee, Graham, and Cochise. Mm-hmm. And we also have up to 350 partner agencies that we work with. And so that reach is also very far and vast. We also are experiencing, unfortunately, an increase in our cost for purchasing food, as well as just the cost of transportation, gas, all of the things that everybody else is also experiencing. It's about a 30% increase. And so that's been a little bit of a shocker. But otherwise, yeah, we're continuing. The need continues to grow, and we're every day showing up and trying to meet it the best way possible. And again, to just really make sure we're reaching all five counties that we serve.
And we have news operations in all five of those counties, and I have been to the food banks in several of them, and well-run, great reach into the community. They listen, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. They listen to what the community needs, and then they answer that. How's it going as far as volunteers, especially now that the pandemic is behind us for the most part? I'm sure a lot of people dropped out, but are they coming back?
Yes. So people are starting to return. So thank you all to those of you who have returned to the fold. It has been a little bit challenging just given that during COVID, we weren't able to be in person. And so those numbers are down. At any given time, we have about 400 to 500 volunteers that help serve in the community. Most of our sites, including in Nogales and Marana, and in Green Valley, have very regular, dedicated volunteers. So big shout out to them. Thank you. And if you're interested in volunteering, you can also contact us online on our website, or you can email us at volunteers with an S at communityfoodbank.org. We are looking for more volunteers. And as we continue to meet this growing need in the community, we need more volunteers. So really appreciate it.
Not sure if you can really answer this, because I don't know that there is an answer, but what is a typical food bank client, and how has that changed over the past few years?
Well, it definitely has changed. We have seen an ever-growing diversity in our participants and neighbors who come for services. A lot of times it's people's very first time in interaction with us, especially based on loss of job or just increased cost right now in living, housing costs being what they are. For some people, they're now finding that they're feeling the squeeze on both the cost of groceries as well as just their living. So having to come to us for the first time ever. So that definitely is a new, different change.
We were a little surprised, and I don't know why, because we knew it was out there. But even when just, say, the cost of eggs soared a few months ago, mm-hmm. we could see that priced out a lot of people from buying eggs. And some people are living very, very close to the edge. And we say one paycheck away from the streets or not having food on the table. You see this every day.
Absolutely. That is a very real thing.
We have two food banks down in our area, one in Green Valley, and then, of course, in Amado, which falls under the Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona. Then we have one in Sahuarita, which is an affiliate member.
Correct.
How does that work?
So the affiliate members are independent, so they operate their own facilities, but they subscribe to all the same requirements and all of the compliance standards that Feeding America sets for us on a national level. So it really just ensures that there's quality control, assurance, and structure so that you can count on the quality of the product and freshness and everything else that goes into the food that we bring into the community.
And then they share with each other.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is a wonderful shared network. And all of our affiliates throughout Southern Arizona are wonderful, and some are more pop-up style that don't have a full facility as beautiful and new and nice as Sahuarita. But everybody does their part, and it is a wonderful collaboration throughout all five counties.
And then we were talking about the volunteers earlier. So the direction is going in things are going in the right direction. The volunteers are coming back. And how is that? How are they feeling when they walk through the door? Are they still a little tentative?
No, people are very, very excited. Happy to be back and to be in person. For those that are, able to return, they have nothing but positive and amazing things to say about how much they missed it. Mm-hmm. And they're also bringing friends and neighbors, which is, of course, what we encourage. It is always harder for us during the summer to recruit volunteers, as a number of our local residents that come in for the winter are then gone during the summer months. And we also have a hard time with some folks who have kids at home and then need to be present during the summer months when their kids are not in school, or shuttling them back and forth to different camps. So we do see a decrease year over year every time the summer rolls around.
And what we see down there is two things about food bank volunteers. One is they work very hard. Mm-hmm. And two is that there's a very strong social structure there. They enjoy seeing each other. They look forward to seeing each other. It's a very important part of their week, that volunteer time.
Yes, absolutely. And we really do feel like they're part of our family. We get to know people very well. It keeps us all really connected. And that's the piece that we hear consistently from volunteers that are returning, what they missed throughout the pandemic.
You arrived as the pandemic was just beginning to wind down late last year. How did the Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona fare during COVID?
I think we fared very well in that we were all able to mobilize very quickly. There was a huge collaboration and an outpouring of support from the community. And I think the staff all came together and worked really well to make sure that we were meeting the huge need that was out there. And again, being responsive in the way in which distribution had to take on a whole new way that it looked, as well as in the environment that we were in, being down at the Kino Sports Complex, which was very intense. And working with the National Guard and, just having a lot of new partners, it was we were very responsive to that need. And it just feels like it brought us together. And I'm hoping that we're stronger and closer now as a result, which is what I feel like I walked into, and that was really beautiful.
Good. And really a shout out to the National Guard. They were helping out quite a bit down in Green Valley and Sahuarita. Huge, just absolutely huge. On May 13th, we had Stamp Out Hunger, where letter carriers nationwide picked up donations at the mailbox. Are the results in?
So we are still tallying those results, but it was a wonderful event. We're at about 210,000 pounds of food that was collected on that one single day, which is our largest one-day event that we hold every year. And a huge thank you to the National Association of Letter Carriers, because they did an incredible job and they pulled double duty that day. They pick up both the donated items as well as then pick up the mail. Mm-hmm. And it was also Mother's Day weekend, which is usually a higher volume weekend for cards.
Yep.
So it was very exciting, lots of energy, and we're really hoping to shatter our 220,000 pound goal, which I think we are on track to do.
Yep. Sounds like it. You are listening to the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Thing Socolo Village studio. Our live line is made possible by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Let's talk about Bill's favorite bakery in town. And of course, that is Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Mona's at the northeastern corner of Swan and Sunrise is open for breakfast and lunch. Treat yourself to some of their incredible offerings, including that famous Danish Kringle. Malia, if you have not been there yet, this is the go-to place for breakfast and lunch.
I hear.
It's true. Find them online at monasdanishbakery.com or go to buckmastershow.com for a link to Mona's Danish Bakery. We'll be right back.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
The Green Valley News and Sahuarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sahuarita Sun, it's all right here.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rialto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
This is Kate Delaney. Tune in later tonight as we talk about everything that happened throughout your day. Tonight at 10 on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Welcome back to the Monday One-on-One presented by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing at Fort Lowell and Dodge and at moesgallery.com. And you can find them on Facebook. I'm Dan Shear, editor of the Green Valley News and the Sahuadita Sun, sitting in for Bill. You've joined us in the middle of the Monday One-on-One interview with Malia Chavez. She is the CEO of the Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona. And Malia, people like to donate around Thanksgiving and Christmas, and I know you're grateful for that. But the need is year-round. How are you encouraging people to give in the summer or the fall?
Well, just through education and hopefully lovely shows like this to really just promote the need that is year-round. And especially as we head into the summer months when we do lose a number of our seasonal residents here in Tucson or in Arizona in general, throughout right. Southern Arizona. But also making sure that we're aware of the fact that the need creeps up during the summer because we have a lot of kids home from school and there's just an ever-growing need for additional food throughout the summer. So there's lots of opportunities to donate, get involved, have food drives, volunteer your time. So any way we can encourage people to not forget about us, the other 10 months out of the year would be fantastic.
And I know that you like donations of food, but frankly, cash in your hands goes a lot farther than it does in my hands at the grocery store.
Absolutely.
How does that work?
With our sourcing team, we're very intentional about when we're purchasing that we are, in fact, using our purchasing power and the volume in which we purchase to be able to get the greatest discount and to make sure that we're meeting the specific needs of the communities that we serve.
Okay. So, and I know sometimes organizations don't like to ask for cash. It almost seems impersonal, but again, you guys can make it go a long way. I heard once it was $9 of purchasing power for every dollar donated. I don't know if that's still accurate, but it's monstrous.
Yes, it is. And we are leveraging that. And we actually saw that during this last quarter with the skyrocketing price of eggs when we did end up purchasing eggs and we got them at such a wonderful rate that, you know, you and I could not get at the grocery store. So it was definitely a clear example of how far our dollar goes as a community food bank.
And you're in five counties. So I want to talk about Graham and Greenlee counties. So this would be for people who aren't aware, this would be like in the Safford area, Duncan, Morenci, that type of those types of things. So very, very rural. How much autonomy do the local food banks have when it comes to deciding what their markets need?
They are pretty autonomous in that they see the need, right? They are on the ground. This is their community. And our job is to be good listeners and to make sure that we're working collaboratively with them. And that's a big priority for me, is making sure that there is equitable distribution and resources and support, and that it is meeting the community needs, which is very diverse depending on where you are in those five counties.
And you hear sometimes from critics who say, no, people go and they go to this food bank and then they go to that one and then they go to this. And so they're kind of milking the system that way. But I do know down in our area, Green Valley and Sahuadita, that there are some protocols in place to make sure that that doesn't happen. You're always going to have people who try to game the system. But how do you try to guard against that to ensure that we can get as many families as possible?
Yeah. So all of our programs have very strict regulations when they are receiving any of our government commodities programs. So those, you have to be registered. It's only distributed once a month. So there are regulations and protocols in place for those. It's the additional donated items that people can go to multiple sites to try to get. And I think what we're seeing is the vast majority of people are on the honor system and not taking advantage of that. But when we do see people coming in for a second visit or a follow-up visit, it really is out of sheer need and necessity. And then it's up to those individual sites to really work with those families or individuals to see where their need is coming from and to make sure that their essential needs are met.
We've had some instances where somebody who is a volunteer actually had to become a client because their situation changes. The really wonderful thing is when a client becomes a volunteer and we see it go the other direction, that they have been helped over the hump, so to speak, by the food bank, and now they are, in a sense, trying to pay it back.
Yes, and we see that time and time again, actually.
That's such a great thing to see, and talk about a committed volunteer. They know it works.
Yes, and we really are trying to be mindful about eliminating the stigma around hunger relief and accessing resources when needed. We really want to make sure that we're available and we're welcoming for people who need it.
Yeah, we had the Sarita Food Bank and Resource Center open up down there and Community Resource Center. And what it does is the area where you go to get the food actually looks like a shopping market. And so there is that stigma that is taken away, and that they get to choose what they want and what's best for their family. And it's a good move. It's a small move, but it's an important one.
Absolutely. That empowerment is so essential, and making sure that people feel welcomed and not judged, and there's an opportunity to really provide services through a lens of empowerment as well as just with a lot of integrity and kindness.
But there still have to be those people who will not darken the door of the food bank, either pride or for whatever reason. Is there an opportunity to reach out to those people? How do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think through education, opportunities like this where we can talk about it and normalize it, and also within the community-based organizations. So I mentioned the 350 partner agencies that we work with throughout communities. Those are faith-based, those are community centers, those are local resource centers. They are all different types of providers, and they are also a huge part of the reach, right? To be able to meet people where they are, to have that rapport and trust, and just making sure that people feel a sense of respect and that there is that option available to them and there isn't the judgment.
Okay, let me set up this next question. In October 2021, the Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona, and you were not there at the time, donated $50,000 in support of Proposition 206, and that would have raised the minimum wage in Tucson to $15 an hour. The head of the food bank at the time said food insecurity is directly tied to economic insecurity and that the minimum wage increase would help deal with that. That's how we justified the campaign donation. The town of Sahuarita, which had supported the community food bank for years, pulled its funding as a result of that donation and gave it to the Sarita Food Bank, which is an affiliate and not directly under your umbrella. That was about a $20,000 to $30,000 hit. The town said they didn't oppose a higher minimum wage. What they opposed was what they saw as a political contribution. So the question is this: what is the relationship between activism or advocacy, getting involved in these types of propositions, and the running of a major community asset like the food bank?
Well, I think we have a tremendous responsibility of education and making sure that we are raising awareness around policies and practices that do help to put us out of business, essentially, because I think that that is a big goal of ours. Most of our work revolves around education and empowerment, and also making sure that people's voices and people's stories and people's needs are also being elevated, and we are sharing that information. So I think the difference for us now at this point from where I've started is that we will no longer make any sort of political monetary contributions for political campaigns. And our board actually passed that last year before I started. But just as a practicing attorney for many years and also in the nonprofit sector, doing a lot of advocacy over the last 20 years, in general, I think it's important to distinguish between our education campaigns, raising awareness, and those financial contributions that definitely can feel more political. They can feel sort of a little bit of a stretch for people. Mm-hmm. And I want to really make sure that we respect that and know that we will not, as the community food bank, be making monetary donations to political campaigns in that way in the future. But again, the education and making sure that people have access to information is part of our role and responsibility and very much built into our mission and has been for the last 40 years.
Okay, we have just a very short amount of time left, but you do more than collect food. Give us a quick rundown of some of the services that you offer.
Oh, we have a number of education programs, both in the schools around education for growing, for water conservation. We have a lovely partnership with the city of Tucson, as well as throughout Southern Arizona on shade and shade equity issues around planting more trees. We also have our local farm here, Las Milpitas in Tucson, but we also have a number of other education programs throughout all of our five counties. Okay. And we also have our community kitchen at Caridad, which in collaboration with Meals on Wheels provides lots of prepared meals for our neighbors.
Okay, that is going to wrap up our Monday one-on-one presented by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing at Fort Lowell and Dodge at moesgallery.com and on Facebook. And our thanks to Malia Chavez. Malia, where can our listeners learn more about the Community Food Bank?
You can go to communityfoodbank.org and you can click on donate. You can click on get involved if you want to volunteer, and you can find out about all of our range of programs.
Okay, very good. This is the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Things Socolo Village Studio. And when we return, you are invited to join us on the live line made possible by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. We'll be right back with Mike Noble with Noble Predictive Insights. He's already looking forward to the 2024 election. We will be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to the Buckmaster Show. I'm Dan Shear, sitting in for Bill, who is celebrating his anniversary in the Caribbean with his wife, Ann. Check out their updates with lots of Ann's photos on his Facebook page. Are you looking for a vacation spot yourself? Our friends over in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, would love to host you just 3 hours east of Tucson. There's a lot to do in Silver City and Grant County, including hiking in the Gila National Wilderness and visiting the Cliff Dwellings National Monument. For a complete listing of the many things to do and great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. We are now welcoming on the live line Mike Noble, Chief of Research and Managing Partner of Noble Predictive Insights. Mike, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yes. You have changed your name. Tell us a little bit about the rebranding of Noble Predictive Insights.
Yeah, no, happy to. I mean, basically, when I founded the company about 7 years ago, OH Predictive Insights, one of the core goals was that, you know, Arizona really didn't have a go-to public opinion firm. Here in Arizona, they always grabbed, services from out of state or, you know, national type services. And for me, it was kind of, hey, can we build a nerdery, as I like to call it, here in the desert? So created that. And 7 years later, we've had some success. And then recently just did some rebranding from OH Predictive Insights to Noble Predictive Insights. So just slight change in the name, but, it's all still the same. It's just new name, same pollster.
Okay. And OH Predictive Insights had a great reputation. And are people migrating over with you? No issues or anything, right?
Yeah, no, it's been really great so far. I mean, that's what's kind of nice about the professional services space. I mean, a lot of it's very much based on your reputation and what you do. So you could even have a very silly name for your company and probably still, you know, have a level of respect to it. So, but yeah, no issues with the rebrand. And I think it went really well. And just, again, a slight change from just switching out the OH for Noble, and it was great because even last year we were ranked the 11th most accurate pollster in the country per 538, which I thought was pretty cool.
That is real cool. Especially after what 2016, 2020, pretty rough times for pollsters out there.
Can't speak for the others, but for us, we did great in both cycles. But this one, you know, we ranked, did quite well when stacking against everybody else in the country. So we're very proud of that.
Yeah, that's an excellent rating. You published a poll in April that I want to talk about, and it wasn't so much the results that surprised me, but that you did it this early. I cannot believe it. The poll asked likely GOP voters who they liked in the presidential race, and Donald Trump won over Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who, by the way, is not even really officially in the race yet. He beat him by 28 percentage points, which is a landslide. Why this early?
Well, this early, these presidential contests are starting off earlier and earlier. But for us, we're taking the measurements because a lot of people get confused of, oh, this polling that we're doing now, let's say April of 2023, you know, is that indicative of where it's going to be in November of 2024? It's like, well, no, obviously not. But as the race goes, you're going to see some movement where the numbers are moving and why. And if you don't have those measurements, you're not going to know. And so, for example, when we polled earlier, I think it was soon after the elections finished, this horse race in the 2024 Republican primary for president, Trump and DeSantis were actually not far apart from each other. I think it was about a 7, maybe 10-point difference between the two. Right now, it's about Trump's at 49%. If the election were held today, that they would vote for him. So basically almost at a majority already. And then only 21% for Ron DeSantis. Everybody else, you know, the Mike Pence's, the Liz Cheney's, Marco Rubio's, Tim Scott's of the world, they're all in single digits with only, 9% saying some other candidates. But what was happening in between those time points makes for a very interesting story, because when the numbers were a lot closer, you got to look at what was happening at that time. At that time, after the elections, you know, Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, he did very well. He won with a pretty strong lead in what's been a kind of a perennial battleground state of Florida, but it's really lurched to the right since DeSantis has been there. But also with Trump and the GOP's underperformance nationally, I think part of the blame was put at Trump's feet with some of these candidates that were going through. So when you have that dueling narrative there, DeSantis was in a good spot. But then what happened in the last, you know, 3-4 months in between there was that, DeSantis, you correctly mentioned, is that he, you know, hasn't announced yet. He's waiting to get through legislative sessions. So essentially boxing in this presidential contest with both arms tied behind his back. But in that interim, what's happened is two things happened. One is Trump's been attacking the heck out of DeSantis, like every which way he's throwing a bunch of stuff against the wall, see what sticks. And so those attacks have been happening. But the second thing is with that court case in Manhattan, that's kind of basically among the GOP, a lot of them kind of chalk that up to like a political witch hunt. So there's a bit of a rally around the flag effect with Trump, with them coming after him and the Mar-a-Lago stuff, et cetera. So those are kind of the narratives and things happening. That's what's where you've seen where the numbers have really shifted. And of course, there's a lot of time from now until then, once DeSantis formally announces and see where that goes. But that's where, when measuring it, seeing where the numbers are moving and why. But that shows where the race went from a tight race to, you know, Trump in a really strong spot right now. But, you know, we still got a long, long road ahead.
Absolutely. And Tim Scott threw his hat into the ring today. DeSantis, last I heard, was expected to actually do that this week, perhaps on Wednesday. But, you know, back to something you said, it was very interesting, because we find that a lot of these voters can get upset by something, and a candidate's numbers can drop, you know, 10 points overnight. And and that makes me wonder, maybe we shouldn't do any polling until like 2 weeks before the election, because it's just, you know how people are, very emotional, and they're upset at someone for the moment, but they're probably going to come back to the fold.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I would say that, you know, with the polling aspect, remember, polling is kind of that measurement in time. So, you know, let's say you're in the field last week for 3-4 days. Well, it's capturing that point in time where voters' opinions and feelings are at. I'd argue that you probably want to have a polling prior because, again, as these ebb and flows happen, for example, let's say the attacks from Trump on DeSantis. The question is that having an impact on Ron DeSantis' numbers? Are those attacks penetrating and causing his support to drop, or is it like Ron DeSantis has political Teflon and it's just bouncing off of him? Well, with this polling, you're able to kind of see essentially where, you know, where the game is going. So as you're going, and I would argue that when you get down to the last few weeks, a lot of voter opinions are pretty well decided, especially in the presidential contest. You look at Trump and Hillary, I think there's about 4% total that were undecided, that were truly undecided in the race. But those 4% ultimately decided who was going to win. So I get the point to it. However, I'd say more polling is better than less to ultimately know where voters are, what's being effective, and what is not effective.
And in 2016, as I recall, there were 16 or 17 GOP candidates in the race. Yeah. And I will tell you, at any one point, I bet a half dozen of them were considered the front runner and, gosh, the person who's going to take it. It was very interesting to watch.
Yeah, like that's a really great example because you're right. Like you saw multiple changes where, like, Dr. Ben Carson, he was leading the polls for a brief bit, but even like Marco Rubio. And remember, a year out from that election, so back in April of 2015, the election was in 2016, the GOP presidential primary with those 16 or so folks, a year out, Jeb Bush was actually number one in the poll.
Right.
We all know. And of those top four that were in, the top four that were in the polling at that time, a year out, of the top four, only one of them finished in the top four later on. That was Ted Cruz.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. That was a very interesting year for polling. And you're right. You need to have that that snapshot in time so that you can kind of compare what was going on. But it seemed like one person's on top of the world in May, and then in June they're dropping out.
True. And it's interesting is that I've heard a lot of talks about this election as well. And people keep referencing back to the previous historical norms that we've seen where the race was a year out to, you know, where it lands up finishing up. It seems like a night and day difference. However, I would say based on a lot of the data that I have been seeing, I think it might be a little bit different this time.
Well, can't wait, but not looking forward to it. How's that sound? Okay, we are going to take a quick break.
New reality we're in.
Yeah, no kidding. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Thing Socolo Village Studio with our guest Mike Noble out of the Phoenix area. Join us on the live line, made possible by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. We'll be back in a minute.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We are also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
This is John Trout. Catch me every weekday morning at 5 before Wake Up Tucson with America in the Morning. Breaking news, weather, politics, and sports on 1030 KVOI The Voice.
And welcome back to the Buckmaster Show. Since 1970, Green Things has been the go-to place for your gardening needs. Green Things is on a gorgeous 13-acre site. It's also home to Socolo Village and all of their fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things on River Road, just west of Brandy Fenton Park, and on the web at greenthingsaz.com and socolovillage.com. We're on the Buckmaster Show live line with Mike Noble. He is head of research for Noble Predictive Insights. Mike, I want to go back to that poll that we were just talking about. We talked about Donald Trump and his strong lead over Ron DeSantis, but none of the other nine candidates mentioned by name even reached double digits. In fact, in third place was none of these candidates, polling at 9%. Now, we should note that Asa Hutchinson, I think, was not included. Tim Scott, or maybe they just weren't mentioned. I don't know. But the next four in line were Mike Pence at 7%, Nikki Haley at 4%, Liz Cheney at 4%, and Marco Rubio at 3%. So I will tell you, we published the poll because of the entertainment value of it. It's just kind of well, it's just kind of fun to see, you know, at this time who people are talking about. And now people are like trying to gird themselves for becoming familiar with some of these candidates we may be seeing over the next year or so. So what else do you have in the works right now as far as polling for the rest of this year, and then what about 2024? What will we see out of Noble Predictive Insights?
Well, we have a lot of great stuff in store for everybody. So not only do we have our regional polls, so we have the AZ POP or Arizona Public Opinion Pulse, which are quarterly trackers. So we also have that NV POP and UT POP. So this same thing in Utah and Nevada. So quarterly surveys. That will run, so we're tracking the numbers in the off year, so where the numbers are moving and why. But then we'll have that. So here in Nevada and Arizona, both battleground states, of the eight battleground states we have in the country, we have two of them, which is great. And then Utah, of course, is just interesting dynamics in and of itself, especially with the whole Mitt Romney, Donald Trump stuff going on over there. And so we have that going, so we'll be continuing to do that. But also, I can't announce fully yet the details of it, but basically it's something that I've been really working on for a while. We'll be launching a national presidential tracker poll in partnership with a national media outlet. So we will actually then be competing directly against like the Wall Street Journal NBC poll or the, you know, YouGov CBS poll, etc. So really excited because this time on the presidential contest, we'll be running a regional. We'll have that stuff going on, but we'll actually have a presidential tracker. And so we get to see how we stack up against some of the best in the business. So could be the best thing we did or may regret it later, but you don't really know until you compete. So really excited for that. And also one of the other things we're working on to roll out next year is essentially like a data portal resource center for folks. So for example, you know, let's say you could go to a place where you could check out not only polling, but hey, I want to see what, you know, previous voter registration statistics are, or what is campaign finance. So where the money state of the race is. So some of these key indicators and even a voter analysis to kind of look at some of these more higher level things. And they're typically siloed out in different areas, and you got to grab the data, you got to convert it, clean it up, visualize it. But we're looking at, hey, how can we put it, you know, kind of all these key indicators of data, how can we put them at one spot for folks to really get everything and get a full view of the race, and not just as, you know, I'm a pollster and I get it. I love polling. However, it's not the only indicator, because, you know, the, sure, the state of how much money you have, where the registration trends are, et cetera, really do impact it. So, but if you have all that data, you can really know really what's going on, but really have all the key factors to see. But your predictability of seeing, you know, who's going to win or lose is going to increase significantly.
And are you for hire? I mean, if a congressional candidate wanted to know what was going on in her district, they can ask you to do some polling there. Is that accurate?
Somewhat. So basically for us,
I thought that was a yes or a no, but go ahead.
No. So it's just a little more nuanced. So in your example of a congressional candidate, in that case, I would have to tell them no. And the reason being is when I moved 4 or 5 years ago from being a Republican pollster to nonpartisan, and there's different, some nonpartisans will take partisan races, but at least for us, you know, and being, you know, are you loyal to a party or are you loyal to the truth or accuracy in the data? I chose the truth and accuracy in the data. So whether you agree with me or not, it doesn't really matter. I care more about being right than making the red team or blue team happy. And so I just don't take on partisan races. So a congressional race or a state legislative race where they have an R or D next to their name won't do it. However, take everything one step removed. So ballot initiatives, city races like city council, et cetera, or county races if they don't have partisanship on there, like we did the Clark County sheriff's race over there in Nevada, which Clark County is like the Maricopa County of Nevada, where Las Vegas and much of the population is. And then we do a lot for government affairs teams, so like special interest groups, chambers of commerce, et cetera, and then government clients. We have a lot like Department of Health Services, Board of Regents, Arizona Department of Education. So those are a lot of the folks that we work with. So basically, we'll take on everyone, corporate, et cetera, but we just won't go directly into the political fray of working directly for an R&D candidate, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. So you would be, you might do these, but you're not going to do it if someone hires you to do it.
Correct. Yeah. So, for example, say like a 501c3 or some outside group or corporate entity that, you know, has a lot of interest in where the, you know, where that race is going to go. They'll tap us because, you know, a couple of things. One is, you know, by being nonpartisan, because there's just, when you're batting for the red team or blue team, one, you can't really bat for the other team because there's this trust factor. So,
right.
So if you're doing work for one, you know, how can we trust you with that? And so for us, and there's plenty of partisan pollsters out there, there's way more partisan pollsters than nonpartisan. Nonpartisan, you could probably fit us all on in one room, most likely. There's not a ton of us. However, again, it was just kind of a choice made. And yes, I've turned down a lot of money over the years. Mm-hmm. However, I really think that, you know, your reputation and then, you know, why people are hiring you and what the focus is for, I think matters. And so for us, it's like, you want someone to tell you what you want to hear? Great. There's plenty of people for that. If you want to know the good, bad, and ugly, or you want to know the truth, well, great. I'm your person. But if you're a decision maker, I would argue you'd much rather know the truth than what people think you want to know, because at the end of the day, you're going to wind up making a bad strategic decision, and that's going to cost way more than, you know, just making sure you feel good at the end of the day.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes sense. But you guys do a lot more than polling. You do market research, data analytics.
Yeah.
Get into a little bit of what else you do.
So we do a lot of stuff. So, for example, with like employee engagement surveys, especially when COVID was happening, we got tapped by a lot of corporate entities and government and others to, you know, what's that new way of work? Because when COVID made landfall, you know, everyone was at home, et cetera. But then they're, okay, what's the new normal? What do my employees want to do? I mean, do they want to come in Monday through Friday? Is it just 2 days a week? Is it all remote, et cetera? Again, what does that look like? So we'll do like organizational surveys on that end. We'll do corporate stuff. So, you know, brand awareness surveys to see where their brand is, see where their competitors are, pre-post ad testing. So you're about to launch, let's say, a six-month campaign of whatever you're trying to advocate or educate on. Well, you can measure beforehand, before you launch the campaign, and then afterwards, hey, where did I move the needle? What messages penetrated? What medians did they go through? So do that stuff. Also, we do a lot of public speaking, do a lot of presentations and stuff. So groups, they'll have me in during their quarterly events or annuals, et cetera, have me come in and basically give a data presentation of the state of the current political climate, what's going on. So basically within an hour, they could be the best expert in the room of all things politics. So that type of stuff. And then, but, you know, definitely my passion is, you know, public affairs. Definitely really enjoy it. But for us, I think it's really these decision makers or folks have challenges or issues like, hey, should I turn left or turn right? You can guess or you can know. And with this survey research, which is really great, you can basically test all those things. Like, hey, I think this is a really good idea, but I also have four other ideas. Okay, of those ones, you know the one you really like? It actually does the worst with your target audience.
Right.
It's nothing against you. It's just at the end of the day, right message, right audience, but you're able to basically test and game those things out ahead of time to ultimately really increase your success with anything that you're doing.
Okay. Wow, the time goes way too fast. Our thanks to Mike Noble of Noble Predictive Insights. Mike, give us a web address where people can find out more.
NoblePredictiveInsights.com, and I think our Twitter handle is just Noble Predictive. But if you just easily Google search us, we're pretty easily come up. I think we're published like 4,000 times just last year alone. So we're pretty Great. Active in the public space. And we have a lot of blogs and things like that. So if you're into data, if you're into this type of stuff, well, we have a lot of resources, a lot of information, because we're just trying to elevate the world around us with data and insight.
Okay, very good. I'm going to be back in this seat on Friday talking to Tom Murphy. He is the mayor of Sahuadita. But on behalf of the team here at the Buckmaster Show, you make it a great rest of your Monday.